is on design for biodiversity, architectural responses to urban ecology, but more on that in a moment. And before going any further, I want to take a moment to first thank Hans Strauch, who's a BArch graduate, and his brother Roger Strauch, who somehow ended up over on the other side of campus in engineering, but who generously provided a gift to support the this symposium this weekend, and more broadly to support the architecture department's commitment to providing instruction in sustainable design. Hans Strauch is with us here this weekend for the symposium, so please join me in expressing our thanks for his and his brother's support. This year's symposium builds upon last year. Some of you may have been here at that time, both in theme as well as in organizational planning. And I want to highlight that this symposium has been a joint effort, or is a joint effort, between the Cornell Department of Architecture and the Oslo School of Architecture and Design. This year, my faculty colleagues Jenny Sabin and Kevin Pratt have worked together over the past few months with friend and colleague Michael Hensel from the Oslo School to develop the weekend's key themes and to pull together a diverse group of speakers who are working at the intersection of urban ecology and architecture. And I would also like to say a note of great thanks to Melissa Constantine, who has worked tirelessly at organizing and pulling together this event. So Melissa, thank you again for your efforts. With regard to the theme of design for biodiversity, architectural responses to urban ecology, I think it's worthwhile to spend just a few moments. I'll reread for you, and maybe you can consciously contemplate the text from the program. I don't know if you ended up with the program, but somewhere there's a, did they end up with the program? Do you have it? You do have it, good. So I will reread that for you. It's not up there, but you can read along with me if you wish. Because I think in there, you know, often we tend to blur over or skim over texts like this that are actually carefully thought out, and they really set the agenda for what's at hand. And make the case that this is not just another sustainability symposium like all the others out there, but there's something actually quite particular and unique in terms of its specific direction. So again, I'm reading from the poster. Since its emergence in the 1970s, the field of urban ecology has investigated relations between living organisms and their urban environments, and has primarily addressed the city at the scale of urban planning. Within this framework, architecture at the building scale has thus far not been extensively tackled. How might architecture actively support multi-species habitats? Can these habitats help us replace existing fossil fuel-dependent mechanistic systems with low-impact, ecologically integrated systems that leverage natural sources? How does reimagining the city in this way change how we think about urban form and phenomenology? And finally, what are the appropriate models to study? So this year's Strauch Symposium will address these questions by focusing on the extended threshold between building and the environment. And if I can find out how to advance. Can I get the next slide? Use the what? Expected green up there. It is the schedule, good. As you can see, the symposium will begin with a keynote lecture this evening from Michael Wells of the UK and from the firm Biodiversity by Design. And that will be followed tomorrow by a wide-ranging program of presentations by many others from many different areas of expertise and interest. And it will end with a closing discussion at the end of the afternoon tomorrow, after which there will be a reception in the Milstein Dome area. And then on Sunday, several of the speakers will still be here and will hope to participate with you in various workshops to help further develop the themes of the symposium into perhaps project briefs that may be included into various studio designs in the upcoming semesters, whether here at Cornell or in Oslo or in other places as well as that. So before we have our keynote speaker, I'm going to ask Michael Hensel, again, who has been instrumental in organizing this and last year's symposium. I'll briefly introduce Michael, who will in turn introduce Michael. Michael Hensel is a friend and colleague, as well as being a professor of architecture at the Oslo School of Architecture and Design, where he directs the Research Center for Architecture and Tectonics. Now, a number of us faculty here at Cornell have colleagues, working relationships, friendships with people at the Oslo School, and Michael is here and bringing us some of his colleagues here, and so we're extending that network as we speak. Michael's a founding member of OCEAN, O-C-E-A-N, Design Research Association, as well as of CSEA, standing for Sustainability Environment Association. Michael somehow likes these sort of big ocean maritime acronyms. He's currently a board member of the Biomimetics Network for Industrial Sustainability, and previously he taught for many years, I won't say how many, at the Architectural Association in London, where he co-directed the Emergent Technologies and Design Program. Michael has written extensively about research by design and about performance-oriented architecture, and he has published incredibly extensively, lectured and exhibited in Europe, the Middle East, in Asia, in Australia, and the Americas, and now for 2 years running here at Cornell. So with that, I'd like to introduce Michael and welcome him back to Cornell.
Thank you, Mark, for this extremely generous introduction. It's always a little bit embarrassing to hear one's own CV, but I can pass this pleasure on soon to the Michael to follow. But before doing this, I just wanted to take the opportunity to thank Hans Strauch, who I had the honor to meet last year, and also had the chance to have a brief conversation after finishing the symposium here. And I remember most importantly the incredible support from his side, but also the shared wish and need to take the topic closer to a professional environment and to the environment where the things that we are talking about are explicitly done. And having said that, this leads us immediately to Michael Wells, who will be speaking tonight. He will be our keynote speaker in this conference. And I would first like to read to you an excerpt of his CV. And then I would like to say a few words about what I appreciate in particular in having him here and in this particular opportunity, and hopefully so bring what we discussed with Hans last year to a kind of full round. The first thing I should say about Mike Wiles is that he has an extraordinary long list of academic accomplishments and professional chartered registrations with organizations that span a wide range. And that is in particular of significance when we think about the themes that we'll be discussing. Because coming from the natural sciences with eventual focus on ecology, Mike nevertheless never lost interest in related topics to do with the environment, with water, and so on. Which explains also the reason why he is chartered in a series of organizations that deal with these particular topics. Mike is a professional ecologist with over 20 years of consultancy experience and 30 years in ecological science. He studied natural science at Cambridge University, UK, and took his PhD from the University of Wales, working on coastal ecosystems. He is founding director of Biodiversity by Design Limited, a company established to span the traditional divides between planning, ecology, landscape architecture, architecture, engineering, and art, always seeking new synergies and directions. A key theme of the work being pursued by Biodiversity by Design is achieving sustainable ecosystem goods and services through design for biodiversity. The work undertaken by the company is truly global, and project areas include the United States, India, Hong Kong, Singapore, La Reunion, Malaysia, the Caribbean, and Spain. Mike is a visiting research fellow and lecturer at the University of Bath School of Architecture and Civil Engineering, where he has developed and teaches a course entitled Ecology, Sustainability, and the Architect, fully examined as part of the MArch degree. He is also lead author and coordinator of a new MSc in Environmental Impact and Design at Bath. He has lectured for several years on the cities programs of the London School of Economics and widely elsewhere in the UK and in Stockholm, Sweden. He is a board member of the UK Landscape Foundation and the Bristol Urban Design Forum, and a member of the operational board of the UK Sustainable Environment Foundation. He also serves on the UK All-Party Parliamentary Committee on Biodiversity. He has authored many articles and papers on green infrastructure design. Of particular relevance to the Strauch Symposium, Mike was key author of Designing for Biodiversity, Productivity and Profit, on green office design, published by the British Council for Offices in 2011. Other key publications include contributions to the UK guidelines on ecological impact assessment and to Green Design from Theory to Practice, edited by Ken Yang, and Arthur Spector, also published in 2011. I would like to take the opportunity to point out again that it is an incredible pleasure to have Mike here, on the one hand, based on his multi-cross and interdisciplinary interest, which is something that is entirely difficult to pull off anywhere, but anybody who has practiced, researched, taught, and pursued in general related academic activities in the United Kingdom knows that interdisciplinary research is not very easy to resource and to take off the ground, mainly because the organizations that stand behind the kind of strategic development and funding of such undertakings don't really have, or until recently did not really have, the framework and the means and perhaps the mind to truly put their weight behind interdisciplinary efforts. Therefore, to pull something like this off is a major accomplishment. But moreover, to frame this in professional terms and to build a practice on this kind of undertaking is truly remarkable. So at this point, I think I shouldn't say more. I should pass the word on to Mike Wiles. Please welcome him.
Truly is extremely embarrassing to have yourself talked about like that. I'm sure it's all lies. But thank you very much, Michael. By returning the compliment, I'm absolutely, truly thrilled to be here today to deliver a keynote lecture. Sign of age when someone asks you to do a keynote lecture, by the way. And thank you, Michael, for the correct pronunciation of Strauch. I think it's Hans and Richard Strauss Symposium in Cornell. My God, fantastic. Ivy League America. You may not know this about me, but my mother was American, God bless, and she'll be looking down from some heavenly celestial sphere with considerable pride right now, I can tell you. And since arrival, I've been soaking up the atmosphere here and learning about the latest endeavors of the school, which advertises itself very well in the field of sustainability and ecology. Just aside, my first love was, still is, really ornithology, and back in the 1970s, God help me, I was a research assistant at the University of Michigan under Professor Grant, and I got the great opportunity to work in the Galapagos Islands on the mecca of biodiversity, got Darwin's finches. And I almost did a PhD in the States. would have ended up emigrating here, I guess, because it takes about 5 decades to do a PhD. And then I went back because of family reasons to the UK and did my doctorate in the Western Isles of Scotland. Nothing urban yet. So when I, you know, to be near the Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology, for example, is a massive thrill for me. And I'm just green with envy about all the research these guys are doing on birds of paradise. And I was also really quite interested and thrilled to hear about the David R. Atkinson Center for Sustainable Future here. A lot of universities are trying to do that, lesser institutions like Harvard, for example. But it's very exciting to see what Cornell has incubated and encouraged around the world and continues to do in that sphere. Turning to this symposium and trying to encapsulate its theme, as far as I see it, we're here to consider urban ecology as a framework for what I would call mutually beneficial life-affirming relationships between built form and the wider environment. Now, if you'd asked me to come up with a topic for a conference close to my heart and my current endeavors, I would have struggled to do a better job than this. And I founded my little company, Biodiversity by Design, about 7 years ago, after a lifetime spent in strange places researching environmental issues, because I thought it was important to have more what you might call agenda-led consultancies, practices that undertook project work, but didn't just do it to satisfy the current planning norms, whatever they might be, or environmental legislation, but actually tried to change clients' attitudes and possibly even social attitudes. And that conviction drove me to and continues today to drive me, to the belief that it's only by addressing the conservation of all species and systems and supporting them that we can hope to save ourselves, and that task should begin on our very doorsteps. So I hope I can move this on. It's not responding. Ah, I know what it's not responding. Separate indicator. Right. So I've called this Biodiversity by Design Principle. When I was asked to talk and do this, I felt not only very intimidated by coming to talk to you bright people, but also the fact that I didn't quite know what to say. So I thought, and then Michael said to me, well, talk about yourself and your practice, because you're coming from a non-academic daily discipline. And yet, I think it needs an academic framework. And so I've called it Principles and Case Studies. Case studies, I'm sure you want to hear, but I'm physiologically incapable of launching into case studies without telling you where the framework of attitude and approach to work comes from. It's a bit about this, you know, consultancy with a heart type thing. So I've got 10 principles, 10's a round number, it's just happened to be something I thought might work, which when I sat down with a glass of wine and a thought, I said, what is it that drives us when clients phone us up? What is it the first thing we're thinking about trying to achieve on projects? And how do I encapsulate that relatively neatly? And so probably number one, and you know, this may seem almost banal in its obviousness to people who bother to come here tonight, is that no matter how small the project, number one thing is that it needs to address the relevance of the modern environmental issues and crisis we find ourselves in. And without wanting to depress everybody who's just had a nice glass of wine and a meal, you can't start environmental work without coming onto this. We try to point out to clients that there's been something called the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment that the Kofi Annan commissioned back in 2000. Over 1,000 scientists worldwide contributed to this. And what did it say? It said, we're doing all right in some lines. You know, we've managed to cure certain diseases. We've reduced poverty in some respects. But actually, there's still massive problems that have been going on before are still happening to us. We've got the global population increases. Estimates vary. But no one is in doubt that we have got a resource issue as a result of the ongoing obvious fact of population increase. And these traditionally, the mantra of environmental problems of habitat loss, fragmentation, islandization, pollution invasion, despite all that we know, and people in this room probably more than most, is going on a go-go around the world in a lot of city development, especially in parts of the world where time is considered to be not on the side of the developers. Climate change is focal to everything we do in every project we approach, and it's not the norm. A lot of people approach projects without this necessarily being on the agenda. I know my dear esteemed colleague in the audience here, Luke Engelbach, and I, who often work together under a different banner, also makes it a key part of his work as a landscape architect. But again, that isn't necessarily the norm in the practice in the United Kingdom, at least. But after Stern and the idea that if we don't spend money now, we're going to spend a lot more later, and the idea that even if it's not us that's doing it, even if you believe the 1% of people who believe that, you don't spend your life gambling on 99% odds. So there is need to do and address it. You only have to see what's happening with climate. Take somewhere like the UK with a massive coastal to land area ratio, and a lot of the time you're working in maritime environments with sea level rise and increased storminess. This is a common scene in England at the moment. We had the worst rainfall in my living memory, certainly, and probably for hundreds of years this year in the UK. And the idea that the natural environment, especially in cities, has a massive role to play is entering into the planning guidance. And of course, the reality, despite all the good things that are known about urban design around the world now, and examples that are appearing, is the majority of cities are still developing without those principles inherent to them. The majority model still of urban development of megacities is sprawl development, long commuting distances, distance between work, live, and play being very large, massive carbon footprints, and all kinds of social issues going with it. And that happens to be Chongqing, which, depending on your estimates, is perhaps one of the most populous urbanized areas on the planet. A sideline, almost, that slipped by under Nagoya in 2000 is the fact that we're losing species. Now, it's very hard, and ecologists have frankly done a lousy job at explaining why it matters. But in terms of the scale of which it's happening, as a matter of fact, over the last 600 million years, in terms of mass extinctions caused by meteorite strikes or whatever, we're in the sixth one here that is on a par in terms of its scale with that. The only difference being that we are absolutely certain we're the cause of this one. And it was stated at Nagoya that we really do need to do something about it because it's like burning all your libraries at once. And it really is important that we have that genetic resource for the future generations to use and to enjoy and for all other extraordinary reasons. But it was almost a non-event. I mean, Nagoya slipped by without so much anybody breaking sweat. There was other important sports events on. It is quite extraordinary to me as a biodiversity specialist that the issue of loss of our the animals that share and plants that share the planet with us it gets so little public concern. And how does all this tie together? Well, before going into that, and I mentioned this in a summary of the talk, was that influencing my thinking is the desire to influence others. And actually, to do that, you can't be a natural scientist. You have to go cross-disciplinary. And Félix Guattari, French philosopher, pointed out that actually the idea of ecological systems needn't only apply to what most of us think of as ecology and birds and bees and environments of that kind, but society itself, people in this room, how they react with other people, the individual reactions applies to different rules of social systems and evolutionary pathways. But that isn't the end of it either, because in fact, the mind, the psyche of the human being, the thoughts, the ecology of your thoughts, is another whole ecology that doesn't obey the laws of society. And actually, what you actually end up doing as a society and the way it takes its funny turns and twists and what becomes flavor of the month and what isn't, is based on a weird, complicated, and ever-evolving mixture of all three ecologies, if you like to use a psychological term. And I think if there's one thing I'd like to say really important at the symposium's outset is that don't get hung up on the technology of urban biodiversity design and environmental systems, because it's far bigger than that. And what you do in design terms can influence societies and people without which small interventions here and there are not going to change the future fate of mankind. What's the second thing we worry about? Well, we certainly worry about what is now traditionally referred to as ecosystem services. It's a buzzword these days, means what biodiversity did for you or does for you. And so in other words, when a client comes to us talking about some animal or plant or something that's in the way of a development, he doesn't realize that we're thinking environment in terms of all of these things and many more besides, in terms of the value that nature provides for us. And I've added this at the end because actually if your design can change a global mindset, that is a value of your design. If you can get people to act more sensibly, rationally, or more economically by your design, you have produced a good, a benefit of your design, as equally valid as increasing its thermal stability. So these are all goods and benefits and services of good environmental ecological design. It's nothing new. It's 1997 since Robert Costanza published his huge review on it, pointing out that twice global GDP would need to be spent to replace all these services mechanistically. You know, great examples are things like mangrove swamps protecting coasts against tsunamis. And, you know, you take that away, you've got to build a big wall, and we all know building big walls in the sea eventually doesn't work, and they cost too much to maintain. Eventually you lose. So this is not, you know, pie in the sky stuff. It's real stuff that affects real countries, but it may not appear in the bottom line of many businesses. We try to tell clients about things like the Teeb Report. My dear friend Pavan Sukhdev, and this amazing achievement as economists talking about how smart countries are investing in their ecosystem services, because ultimately the country becomes richer. Lots of all kinds of philosophical, you could have five symposia just on this topic. But it is the fundamental that you can't say that the environmental aspects of ecological urban design are nice to haves. They're inherent and fundamental to it. And what's been happening very recently in the UK, despite the ghastly recession and all the financial uncertainties, has been that there has been a huge change in emphasis on ecological environmental policy and law. And what has happened is the word value is cropping up everywhere. We had, the first country in Europe to do a full national ecosystem services assessment, which actually looks at the monetized value of the things you can actually potentially partly monetize. And I say partly so that Felix Guattari's ghost doesn't come and strike me down as I speak. But basically, of quantifying what you can. And indeed, there were particular aspects of that big report which focused on urban systems. And here's done by economists and environmentalists together, the economic assessment of ecosystem services by UK urban habitats. So actually looking at what that stuff that often gets cut out in the value engineering, as they call it, of design projects, actually means in economic terms. And if you don't have it, how much poorer your city gets if you happen to be mayor of it, for example. Biodiversity strategies in terms of saving nature in tooth and claw have also changed their emphasis. So here you see Biodiversity 2020. Since Rio, it's changed theme many, many times. And this time it's a strategy for England's wildlife and ecosystem services. Again, bringing in the idea that that has to have its monetized value made apparent. It's no point saying we can't monetize it all. You can't put the value on the Mona Lisa, let's not bother. Because we all know that it's all going too fast to be so precious about it. And then a white paper produced by the current coalition government in the UK is called The Natural Choice, Securing the Value of Nature. They've cottoned onto this in a big way. They think they can have a win-win and actually change it. And actually, people don't realize, but in the treasury accounts of the United Kingdom, ecosystem services now have to be accounted. If in another 20 years that actually has to happen for business development projects, we're gonna see some very, very different projects getting built. So what is, in terms of ecosystem services, what is our particular focus? Well, we have a particular angle in saying, if green is good, then biodiverse green is better. And to do that, you can't take a pick list approach because systems, as you know, ecosystems don't work if you take bits out. However, as I was discussing my dear friend Luke earlier this evening, in different cultures and different environments and in different sociological ecologies, you can't use the same bits. You have to do the functionality potentially in different ways. There's different ways of skinning a cat. Another thing we say is that don't ignore the small bits. The big bits, as we know in ecological terms, are made up of small bits. The number of schemes that we see where little patches are considered unworthy of consideration and it's all about nature reserves and whatever are all too common. And that's another key focus of our work. We look for work and publications in the academic world which are focusing on the biodiversity value of ecosystem services, i.e. what a biodiverse system will do in ecosystem terms better than a monoculture. So here's an example relating to runoff treatment of wetlands and whether a biodiverse system works better. Here's one about whether green roofs function better. Here's one that's particularly interesting to me, done in Sheffield, as to whether more biodiverse systems give a more uplifting in psychological terms, which they appear to be, certainly in the UK, controlled experiments. And I'll come back to this. Another thing we do in terms of ecosystem service, say if the client isn't sure what to do, then we encourage the use of experimentation, living experiments that get built as part of design. If you're not sure what to do, let's do an experiment together. Work with clients to achieve things that perhaps teach us something. That's an example in Switzerland of a trial roof. What else do we do? Well, if we really believe in this stuff, then as you would if you're an architect setting parameters for a roof design or a building or a glazing transmissivity, then you put parameters to it. But we don't do that in biodiversity. We say, oh, well, it'd be nice if there's a few brown bears running around the woods, but you know, it's just a nice to have and it's not really thought of. But actually, funnily enough, if you start thinking about it in a quantitative way and saying, well, actually, let's have two brown bears, one black bear and a pink bear, then actually you have to really think about it and you have to design for that, and that changes your design, and that may end up with some interesting things going on with the architecture. This is a scheme we did with Ken Yang for a competition we didn't win, but came close to winning, in Gyeongji in Korea, for a new urban administrative center in Gyeongji. And as you know, with Ken Yang, he does vertical greenery on his buildings. Well, what he's been very keen to do is saying green, he thinks, is very important at all levels for human psychological benefit and other things. But how can you make it more functional? And so what we did is we looked at the whole landscape which we designed, which had all kinds of ecosystem services, functionalities, and then said, okay, these are the components that make that ecosystem work, keep it clean, eat the pests, do all the things. How many of each of those do we want? What's on the menu? Not a comestible menu, I hope, but nonetheless. And can we actually be precise about this? And you say, well, it's a bit of a vainglorious endeavor, but the fact is that where we have done this successfully, we've been about 80 or 90% accurate sometimes. So in other words, when you really put your mind to it, you can predict, and that does affect the design and the areas and spaces you leave for the things. Even the layout of your master plan can be affected by this. What is the other big thing? Well, this is what was said by Professor early on in the introduction to this is, well, if we're here, we're here for one particular reason, is that we're quite interested in how disciplines cross and meet. So in actual practice, what does that mean? Well, for us, it means that we really do try hard to convince old and new opponents of our point of view, because we have an agenda, and we try and win new support from areas that have never thought about it. So for example, landscape architects, as I say, I work a lot with Luke Engelbach, he's a landscape architect with a difference, because he has this sort of thing, we don't have to discuss it, he's already on board with all these issues, and they're very ecologically minded. But it's interesting that despite people like Luke and others who have done this since for the last 30 years, McHarg is, you know, was going back, was a person before Luke's time who was saying all this stuff then, but it wasn't until 2009, for example, that the American Institute of Landscape Architects, the Society of Landscape Architects, said we should worry about environmental ecosystem services and regenerate ecological capacity. So that's all great stuff, but 2009, guys, that's not that long ago. So what strikes me about this is that it's very, very new to this table, to something that to me would have been blindingly obvious 30 years ago. And the other thing is that in talking to clients is ecology and nature in cities doesn't always have to look like a jungle. This is a drawing that Luke did for a project he and I are working on in Greenwich, which shows how urban form of certain tree species can actually work better to provide an ecosystem services as a windbreak, for example. And that, you know, designing for shelter and shade, you know, sometimes needs a bit of thought. And it's not always the natural system that in total, or elements of the natural, yes, but not all of it. And as an ecologist, you make that step across as you come into an urban system. What about architects? Well, interesting, the environmental movement and the David Attenboroughs of this world and all the rest of it have led to a backlash amongst some architects. There's an example of one guy from the Future Cities Project who is clearly, if you read that, very upset about the idea that he's a French chef who can't use garlic and snails anymore. Basically, it's like we're spoiling the party. We're telling all this ecological frim-fram has to be thought of in architecture. What happens to legibility in design? What happens to purity of design concepts? Are ecologists trying to kill all that? What about treading lightly on the earth? To hell with that. We want to smash down on the earth and show how clever we are. And actually, although I actually understand the emotion of this, and of course it's a complete misconception, and actually the fault is totally with the ecologists for not explaining what the hell they're talking about. What I try and do is say, look, we are trying to give you more things to design with, not less. And we're not saying, in the same way as having a building without a roof is probably going to be a bit damp, having a building that isn't responding to the environmental issues today is probably a bit irrelevant. Ecologists need some convincing too, because there's a lot of them out there, and this is a quote from a British ecologist who runs one of the natural conservancies, is that obviously they're not on board with urban issues either, because they think it's not where it's the cheesecake's at. If you're a serious ecologist, you're wrestling with the alligators, you're chasing after the bears. What are you doing in a city? You call yourself an ecologist? So this is other aspects that need to be addressed in terms of the work that we do. sociologists, this book by Kurt Jacks, quite interesting because ecosystem functionality is a big buzzword. Let's have a more functioning ecosystem. Let's restore ecosystem functionality. Society for Ecological Restoration, huge scientific society. And there is a scientific conceit that makes people think that it's all about science. Well, it's not, because ecosystem functionality without a social element actually doesn't mean anything semantically, because nearly all the environments, including the Amazon jungle that we see, has a huge anthropogenic element. And only by addressing that issue and making it relevant to the 21st century can you get into a societal discourse that actually enables you to protect it and be a good steward of it. We work with art and artists because actually they're damn sight better at conveying changing hearts and mind, the third ecology of Felix Guattari, than I am, because they know how hearts and minds are affected by purely beautiful things. A house for bats, for example, in London. And the world of advertising, I mean, it wasn't overlooked by the 16th century Italian Guinigi when he built this tower in Lucca and decided to declare his wealth by putting Quercus ilex trees on the roof to show how wealthy he was. But it is now used as the symbol of the green roof movement of Italy. I think we need to review some of these issues and symbolisms because we are trying to change hearts and minds. And you don't do that if everything you design as an ecological designer looks, frankly, a mess all throughout the year. Aesthetics, which are often ignored in terms of most people's attitudes to these things, which can be changed, of course, but it does help if you actually think, well, in the winter, what's it going to look like? Key thing is the genus loci, or the genus loci, opinions vary of how you pronounce that or say that. What does it mean? It means the genius of place. Now, David Good, who suggested me for this speech tonight, would have killed me if I hadn't put this slide in, because it's about what his entire life's work was trying to get the best bits of habitat, which exist quite a lot in our cities, preserved, because you start with the best bits. You preserve what bits of crown jewel you've got left. That's where you get your biggest seed bank from, in every sense, psychologically and in real terms. But in terms of actually celebrating the genus loci, the big thing we're trying to avoid is good environmentalism. Good environmentalism is the death of design. If you tick the box of all the environmental things you're trying to do in a very religious way, you end up with everything that's homogenized, same, and very worthy. And nothing is going to get you out of bed in the morning, excite you. Designers are designers because they're born that way. They have got skills like the person who can play the violin. I think that you need to work with people who can make exceptional, mind-stopping places. So it's not merely just a matter of getting all the science right. And that's an important point to make, to realize. And this is nothing new. Alexander Pope said this, and I think it was the 18th century, when he wrote that the genius, consult the genius of the place in all, paint as you plant and as you work design. The idea that you actually have to design and develop from a place, from its very core, from its very spirit, if you're going to get something that touches the human psyche and affects it. So we try and seek that in everything we do. And if it means making cultural references, not the traditional domain of the ecologist, then we'll look for those things. It's Rome and London, very different place back then, with the Thames 2 miles wide at the Strand. And something I learned in a beautiful sentence from James Wine's book on architecture is that if it ain't beautiful, kid, it ain't going to catch on. Because ultimately, we do respond to things that shock our eyes and attract us. This is a functional design in Nouvelle-Calédonie for a center that is needed to be shaded from the sun. But how better to shade it than in stunning architecture that responds and relates by mimicry fashion to the environment in which it's set? And something else that I learned from working across disciplinary again in London for the biodiversity strategy for London with Ken Livingstone is that who are you doing this for? Everybody looks at this stuff from a different social and psychological lens. And you very easily design stuff without realizing that it isn't an abstract process, that you're designing into that whole psychological medium. And if you actually design with some knowledge of that medium, the relevance of it becomes stronger. BEN stands for the Black Environment Network, which is an organization in the UK which works cross-culturally to get people from non-Caucasian minorities in the UK into environmental stewardship, because they're not interested. In the UK, very few get involved because the environment and the way it's presented is irrelevant to them. This amazing book, Urban Place, I recommend it to you, the Piedmont Project, and how that attempted an American university to combat what was beautifully called locational autism, the ability to be anywhere and nowhere, to not know your place, not know that tree, to not know the river and care less, to live in a hypermedia world where none of this means a damn thing. And actually, you can do a lot through design to combat that malady. Biophilic design is something that suddenly I saw it called a design philosophy, and I thought so many things fell into place that I've been doing, trying to do in my own little way for 20 years. Stephen Kellert, as a psychologist of some renown in the States, combining with probably the most famous living biologist in evolutionary biology, Edward Wilson, coming up with the idea of biophilia, the idea that despite all the cultural and age and sex related differences in our opinions and views on things, there are some threads that go across all of that in terms of our reaction to nature. There are certain elements of environments where you say where somebody wants to live, and they turn out to be, people like to be on prominent places with a large and interesting spatial topographical relationships in savanna type semi-wooded landscapes near clean water. And those are the key elements of what has become known now as biophilic design, an amazing book which I really recommend to you. Because by bringing those elements together, you bring in the ecosystem goods and services for psychological benefit. We are a nation in the UK that spends billions of dollars or pounds on drugs to keep our brains right. And we've also found by recent research in the UK, as I mentioned earlier, that biodiversity and green space can heal us in that sense. This is not tree-hugging frim-fram. This is scientifically researched, tested stuff in controlled group experimentation. The leading light here is Roger Ulrich in the States. He's published amazing treatise on how people's recovery times in hospital, the amount of time they spend in hospital, the amount of medicine they take when they're in hospital, all are affected very, very significantly by views of natural and bucolic environments. Kuo in Illinois has been for 20 years proving that environments with treed landscapes, for example, significantly reduce crime in socioeconomically comparative environments. And when you really want to understand what these elements are, look at children and how they respond to urban environments and designs. Their responses are visceral, and you would say, if you wish to take that line, if you're an evolutionary biologist, primal. If you're an evolutionary biologist, we've only been around 250,000 years, a heartbeat in evolutionary time. And the responses to natural and biomimic entities and forms and shapes is extraordinarily strong. So for example, a scheme I worked on with Guy Battle in Nottingham and with Michael Hopkins Architects is creating an environment for learning, a new campus, which is what I call biophilic learning. All the elements that McKellar talks about are in this design. In fact, he even uses this design as the cover for his book on the subject of building for nature. Here's an example of biophilic housing at Barn Elms in London, the largest urban wetland in Europe, which was designed for wildlife, as Richard Peter Scott's last big project. His dream was to have an urban site for wildfowl and wildlife. I mean, it's not big by American or Canadian standards, not by Ducks Unlimited standards, but it's a big site for an urban site when you consider the real estate values in London. And all these houses sold at massive premiums before the first brick was laid. That is the economic value of nature. People want to be there. It's very simple. Biophilic working. This office I went to when I was working for English Partnerships in England, the National Regeneration Agency, is a living example of a biophilic office in terms of all the design elements which show not only is it extremely sustainable in the traditional economy of architecture terms and energy, but the responses of the inhabitants of that office, the frequency with which they renew their leases, the contentment and the productivity are all record-breaking for the north of England. What else we can do is take things away. And if you're not getting through to people at this point, just show what happens when it's not there. That is the exit view you get from Southampton Railway Station in the United Kingdom. If there is anything more Orwellian, you know, and I think that by just showing people the taking away, I actually believe that in evolutionary biology sense, we have a tremendous adaptivity as a species to ignore loss. Because if you constantly focus on what you've just lost, you can't get on with your life. So like having a bad marriage, if you can't get over it, your life is going to be pretty tricky. So we adapt to less things all the time. A wonderful book published recently called Paradise Lost shows how the states and places when we first colonizers came across from Europe could walk over places like Lawrence River on the backs of salmon. And we've lost that idea of the abundance of nature, and it's very easy to adapt to a lower level. Take it away, show them what it would be like, say, which would you rather live in? There are a lot of myths around, urban myths, like vegetation destroys heritage buildings, National Trust in England looks after old buildings, has shown the opposite is true. By and large, with certain maintenance issues taken into consideration, vegetation prolongs the life of the understructure of old stone buildings. And here, big trees can actually do more good in the city. And actually, the building of big trees and the effect of their roots can be designed. There's designs that can address the potential risks. Another myth is that wildlife will infest everything. Insects will get in your dinner, and if you can't have it anywhere near a clinical facility. This is a clinic in Switzerland called Clinic in Basel, where I take clients to see and say, look, the idea is you're ill, you walk in, you come out the other end, you're well. And basically, it's all a green roof. There are green roofs everywhere. There is wildlife everywhere. There is bird song. There is falling water. There is a cooling feel in a very hot day. And it's an astonishing, healing place by anybody's standards. I mean, it's just a joy to experience. Another one is everything will leak. There was a corrupt architect in the UK in the 70s called Poulton, and he built a lot of cheap houses, and all the roofs, flat roofs, leaked. Ever since then, we've had a massive fear in the UK of flat roofs and green roofs. But actually, it's an example in Switzerland, a marvelous example I'll come back to, of a national park on a roof, which is basically a tremendous meadow which has been there for 100 years, and actually the only place where they've never had to replace the waterproofing is under the meadow. It protects against weathering and temperature changes. When you're doing this, though, you have to make sure you don't introduce new hazards. This could take symposia on itself, but we'll give you one example, is the issue of birds and glazing. And there's been tremendous stuff done in America, so which is why I chose this example. Canada and America have got marvelous guidelines now on how to reduce the risk of birds flying to glazing. Hundreds of millions of birds a year die this way across the Americas. The Great Lakes especially are key migrant pathways, and you may have heard in places like Toronto, they've had massive issues. What they've done is they've solved the problem in large ways through social people power. One example in Toronto where the Kustuwaka building was killing millions of birds, basically they turn off the lights for two of the months of the migrant season, they reduce the problem by 75%. So it's just that, but also there's a new type of glazing that's come out because people have thought, let's address the problem through Pilkington, which is called Ornilux, which means that birds see it as opaque and they don't fly into it. There are many other issues, like this was a dead birds in a building that reflected the environment outside, like a big piece of glazing in Switzerland, Basel, which wasn't so clever. And if we believe all this stuff, then we can't just go out there and do practice. We have to deal with guidance and be at the cutting edge of that. It starts with site assessment, so we contributed to this. It's about getting net gain. It's not holding the line. It's putting reparation for the past. And so these are other guidance documents we've contributed to. And bear in mind that the city-urban environment isn't just minor issues that are actually just dealing with the lesser grade nature. Don't forget, many cities around the world in urban areas are built on rivers. And here's an example of the work we did to producing guidance for tidal river edges, like the Thames, where tremendous restoration can go on. I'll come back to this. And working with architects who are looking at vegetated buildings and saying, how can we make this more functional? There's a book published with Ken Yang, and mentioned this earlier with Michael Hensel, saying about office design, how that can increase productivity. One of the biggest bills of business in the UK is sick leave days. If you reduce that by 5 to 10%, the saving for business is billions of dollars. So you actually have to think about these issues in economic terms. And what I've done is very quickly give you 7 quick case studies. Now, these are at different scales of intervention and purposely trying to build up from a unit to a larger scale. And they're all things, some are built, some are not. This was a national competition to build a house for bats in London because they wanted to get the conservation status of these amazing evolutionary entities into the public mind and advertise the work of the Wetland Center. Bats have been around a lot longer than we have, hundreds of millions of years. And here we have a bat doing what they do well, which is to catch flying insects. And they can be tremendous help to us in reducing biting insects and so forth in our environments. If you start designing for bats and different species of bats, you find you design different spaces for people, which are much more heterogeneous and interesting, shaped and varied, because bats need different things. So you get some interesting side benefits from that. And our response was not only trying to adapt to the maximum species diversity of these animals, but to be a little bit visually attracting and actually to be modular in a modern architectural sense so that it was easy to roll this out elsewhere in the country and have more actual habitat undisturbed for these animals which have had such a bad press and lost so much of their habitat. And indeed, to get people up close and personal with things they don't see, making the unapparent apparent, using all the modern technology we can for modern cooling systems, for interior visual displays to actually reveal the secret life of the animals. So that's one intervention, architecture and environment. Talking about human environment, on a similar but slightly larger scale, an embankment in London, an infill site in Portobello. Very, very dense urban setting. An embankment along a railway with non-native sycamore on it and some bramble, and a desire from the local authority to realize a different design for the whole area here. And working with Luke Engelbach, who again is in the audience tonight, was to try and look at it in terms of a functional analysis, what Luke calls a landscape of layers, looking at every layer of the architecture and every layer of the landscape to see how it could function, and how it could function synchronously and synergistically. And actually, taking references, as I say, if you want to get a new idea, look in the library. Because actually, Malcolm Wells, back in the 70s, was talking about underground living and earth-sheltered buildings for all kinds of extraordinarily strong environmental reasons. And so you end up with a design that is essentially an earth-sheltered design. And it's not just a building covered in vegetation. This is not the point of showing this. The point is how all the bits work together and to try work really hard to maximize ecosystem services. And for example, how you then work in other structures of sustainability, such as photovoltaics, how lighting works with it, how refuges work with it, how screens and barriers work with it. And introducing new elements in very, very small settings, micro-sized design of ponds in a very tight site and still making it functional. Taking something as simple as a wall or a hedge and saying, how could that be designed to maximize its living functionality rather than just using a few simple materials? So your invertebrate animals or whatever can make their way from here through an underground passerelle. This is a picture taken in Switzerland, but that was the idea, through vertical features of different types and persuasions into a roof garden. And we actually had the idea of living walls of this kind. This is a real example in Southampton of native species in a living facade in soil. Now, this is an irrigated system, and you don't always have water available for this because water is at a premium. But in certain applications, it is worth spending the money to do this because of the cooling benefits of this and the biodiversity benefits. It's like having a vertical soil, and not all living walls and surfaces are like that. And going onto a roof, they often say, well, I want PV on the roof, I want solar thermal, I can't have wildlife. And in overlooking, that's an out-of-focus picture, but it was still the best picture to show you of how the two work perfectly together. In fact, they have shown in Switzerland that the two actually are synergistic in mechanistic terms because the green roof can reduce the increase the electrical conductivity of the photovoltaics by up to 20%, and therefore increase the efficiency of the photocells. And looking in Switzerland examples of actually having real biodiverse landscapes as was set up in what the chair of the school said earlier about real ecological systems on buildings. Can it happen? This is an example of it. This is a meadow 100 years old, which I defy most ecologists to say that they were on a roof. If you blindfolded them, helicoptered them in, said, where are you? They would say they were in the best meadow in Switzerland. The thing is, in this part of Switzerland, there aren't any meadows left. The only meadow left is on this roof of this waterworks, because we've got rid of all the rest through progress. Well, on the roof here, we also design in ideas such as refuges for invertebrates. Why? Because most life starts from death, because the invertebrates that live in deadwood and things are often predators of the pests that often assail us in urban environments. And actually look then, once you've got those elements right, you can start worrying about the sort of little bits and pieces and the cheap thrills of artificial refuges for certain species. Then it's actually matricizing the whole thing to see, for example, in sustainable urban drainage terms, how all these different bits work hard in different things, not only in terms of the traditional benefits for, say, treating water cleansing, which is what suds are normally thought for, are used for, in a very monothematic way, but what is their aesthetic value? What is their sales benefit? These are not things that most practices even concern themselves with. This is a slide from Studio Engelbach. Moving to a slightly larger scale, a public building in the north of England where there isn't an awful lot of money to throw around, was brought up in the north of England, and I know that for a fact. Working with Andrew Wright Associates, international competition, which we won with Andrew Wright, for a new sports center. And again, the elements of biophilic design were integral to the concept from the start because we know from the research that sport and exercise undertaken in natural environments is beneficial to a far greater extent than those in sterile environments. So from this is for the future to go on the website, so it's not actually to be read now. But the one point I point you to is that it wasn't just the professional's choice of winner, it was the public's choice response to it emotionally. The actual dome design is all about very, very clever maximizing of use of space. The fact that it looks a bit like a ladybug is slightly coincidental, I suspect. But there are a lot of things going on here in terms of biophilia. And actually, it is showing that how you have to think about the whole thing holistically. For example, in this entranceway, which is celebrating the arrival of this building in an area which normally doesn't get an awful lot of regeneration, it's next to water. The biophilic properties of that are absolutely focal, respecting pure, clean water. That's a filtered, treated water that has come through vegetative treatment systems. So if you're going to climb a rock and it's raining all the time, you do it indoors, okay, but you've got to have your view so you're connected to this natural network of sights and sounds. And what we did in terms of the vegetation on the roof and so on is said, right, this isn't a chance to advertise an iconic building. Let's advertise what's good of the wider environment. So this is a mind map of the best things of a place called the Cover Sands in that part of the world, which is the rare habitats which are disappearing. So let's see if we can recreate what I call analog, simplified but functional versions of these on the roof of the building, and actually say this is what you're celebrating. So you're celebrating sport, recreational regeneration of Scunthorpe, and the amazing things in nature around you may not even know exist. And that gets you into all kinds of technical debates about how you achieve it on different types of surfaces and slopes, and you end up with an emerging building trying to achieve these sorts of things. These things apply wherever in the world, and in Singapore, Lee Kuan Yew, former premier, made it his business to develop a new marketing strategy for the whole of Singapore, which he called the City of Gardens and Water. He's not an idiot. He realized that the only way to compete in the very, very tough world of Southeast Asia, everyone's cutting each other's throats for the jobs and the mines of the West, is to give a place that's really attractive and life-affirming to live in. So he then moved that tagline to the city from, sorry, it was a city and a garden, and it moved to City of Gardens and Water, all the elements of biophilic design. And we ended up with Ken Yang working on this particular development where it wasn't just greening, it was supposed to be ecological principles that were underpinning it. Trying to develop a development that, from the outset, addressed all of these ecosystem services. A step beyond what they normally do there. A site that is a typical site waiting for development, just grassed up with non-native grasses, non-native trees here, and a few interesting trees, which some of which are native here. But we look to preserve trees such as these rain trees from the Amazon, based in Brazil, sorry, because they are very functional ecosystem terms in the city. They may not be native, but they are doing an extremely good job in that location. But we do, the first thing is an analysis of context to see what ecosystems we can tie into, connect with, and refer to. And then working in three-dimensional modeling, because actually, to us as ecologists, buildings are cliffs and rocks and forms and shapes within which ecosystems are happening. So what is the analog ecosystem that applies in a gully in that high dense context? Well, it turns out that the remaining habitat in Singapore that's most valued is woodland rills in dense wooded settings, watercourses coming through, very shaded environments with watercourses. A lot of the rarer species are living there. So you start getting a design palette to see in these fringes and bits and pieces, how can you get those to work hard and to function? How can the building form reflect and respond to those? For example, this species of an owl that is native to the island, but is actually able to tolerate human disturbance and presence and does a good job at dealing with urban pests like rats. So this might be a place it would nest in a natural environment. Providing an artificial structure for it close to the building starts talking to the inhabitant of the building that you're doing something beyond that for the purely human. And you're doing it for a functional reason. And here through the central spine of the development, a narrow and quite shaded, but nonetheless very functional woodland stream, if you like. Aerated, circulated, clean water, dealing with the issues of mosquitoes and so on, very, very carefully. And designed with the species that would exist in those sort of shaded environments in Singapore. And then moving on to the retaining such big trees as there are, but also enriching that environment with the field layer and all these elements which are often forgotten because the woodland isn't just trees. And looking at the issue of rainwater capture, Singapore's in a vulnerable position with resources. It depends quite a lot on Malaysia for water. And you know it wants to be sustainable in its water resources, but it doesn't harvest the ample rain. So rain gardens, the issue of capturing that water, storing it underground tanks, all of the technologies associated with that are integral to the scheme. And when you're doing living facades, you know it is cheaper to do it with climbers than any other method. But some climbers, even if they don't climb up all the building, you can start having physical references to design and nature in the hard architectural features that you add. And then you can add on other bits for species that might come in and eat your insects, your mosquitoes or your pests, And here you have species from the woods of the natural tropical rainforest there, grafted onto trees, and bats of the city coming in also have an important role to play in maintaining the ecological equilibrium. And again, the species matrix, trying to quantify it, formalize it for fauna, for flora, and actually going down each of these animals in turn and seeing what is the real chance of them coming in, and how often, and how many species, and are they going to breed, or are they just going to visit on a Friday night if they've lost their way? And basically looking at native and non-native species, but an emphasis on native, but when it's non-native, seeing if it can be valuable for native wildlife, bearing in mind that you have to get a balance right. You don't want one or two species predominating and creating problems. Two more, going to a bigger scale still, and saying that the view from the window is the view that heals, then we get to London and we look about the external environment of development. Very interesting site on the River Thames, the River Wandle joining it. Now this is an old Shell oiling depot with derelict land. Now derelict land in the UK in urban areas is very interesting and challenging. The nearest example I can give you is the High Line in New York City, which I was involved with about 10, 15 years ago, and the year before it became the High Line Park, the most visited park unit area in the USA. And that was basically a brownfield site, which means species from all over the world colonizing it from the ballast of ships and so on and so forth. Many of the species, frankly, that I see on brownfield sites like this in London, I saw on the High Line in New York. An interesting bit of recombinant ecology there. But full of wildlife. I remember walking along the High Line, New York City, and being walking through clouds of monarch butterflies as if I was in Alice in Wonderland. And there is a huge biophilic benefit of these sites. And the fact of the matter is, a lot of these have very rare genetically rare organisms on them, because they've all been sprayed out by agricultural activities in the countryside. So far from this being a little bit of, you know, also ran habitat, it's a strange bit of habitat that's got, it's almost like a zoo for these rarer species. And it's this sort of site, what it looks like. You see a bit of broken down river wall, or better repair that. No, but for us, that's a design opportunity. It's the sort of habitat you get. You can't keep that if you redevelop it, but what can we do to replace it? So you think of riverside environments, and a lot of rare invertebrates live in riverside gravels. Let's have a roof that you can put it on. Okay, but maybe the roof needs to flood. Maybe the roof needs to flood and create various hydrologic regimes, a horror of many developments conceived of in the past. There's an example of a floodable roof in Switzerland, the Rossetti Bau building, which is full of very rare invertebrates of the river gravel edge environment and works incredibly well as an urban aerial nature reserve. Here's the development in Wandsworth. So you have the formal landscapes, but you also have the informal biodiversity going on. But it doesn't stop there. Here you have the River Thames, and as I say, the environmental design of ecological design in cities is not just the urban architecture, the structure, because when you do the structures in here, you're designing the whole site. The fringes and the boundaries become vital. We could have ignored the River Thames, instead of which we said, what's the story there? Can it become interesting? Can locational autism and unknowing of the place around you be combated? Here is a fish that lives there. It's called the smelt. It's a European rare species. And it happens to have one of its last breeding sites in London at the confluence of those two rivers. What can we do for it? Well, we've got a river wall that needs knocking down. If you knock that back and create an interesting three-dimensional architectural form responding to the architecture of the buildings and putting them together with a shade environment and everything considered, you end up with an intertidal system which the baby fish can live and grow in and hide in the reeds. So we start creating that, and you start working on the form thereof in relation to the built form of a building next to it. And you start building the terraces and shaping them and forming them for real and then planting them. And you end up with a habitat for these rare species that also gives a little bit of that bucolic scene, because actually a lot of urban frontages and water in cities can be very sterile. The other thing was that there were some very big iconic bird species, herons and cormorants, which are common species. There's no law protecting them in England in the winter. And basically, they were the largest number of anywhere in London, outside, near central London, anywhere. And they were roosting on this feature. It's quite a dramatic sight for Londoners. But there was nothing to protect them. And we needed to get rid of this feature because it wasn't going to work with a new development. This is an oiling jetty for large ships. So we could have just said, forget it. But we actually convinced the developer. He didn't have to do this, bear in mind. We spent about $300,000 or $400,000 buying some old barges from Holland, which were going to be used in the Second World War, adapting them as bird hotels, floating them up the Thames, and installing them in some sort of grandiose artwork here to provide the alternative roosts. And there they are, happily roosting on these features. Now, you might think, what on earth are you doing this in a time of difficult financial circumstances? And the answer is, quite simple. I was walking along not too long ago. There was a guy who happened to be from Holland, and I asked him what he was doing. And he said, "I'm looking at those barges there." And I said, "Why are you doing that?" He said, "Well, it's quite interesting." He says, "I see the birds." So I said, "Well, why do you think that was done?" I said, because I didn't tell him that I designed it. I said, "Why do you think it was done?" He says, "I have no idea." He said, "But as far as I'm concerned," he says, "they're fish birds, right? Fish birds." So I said, "Yeah, they eat fish. Yeah, that's right." He says, "Well, I'll tell you what." He says, "If I was living here, I see fish birds, means fish in the river, means a good place to live, right?" And I think that is the point, that biodiversity in urban areas are ecosystem service they provide as an early warning system for the collapse of our environment, to wit, for example, the predators like peregrine falcons, which died out through DDT poisoning. Had we not, had Derek Ratcliffe in England not discovered that fact, loads of more babies would have died. And we owe it to a healthy environment around ourselves, not only about environmental stewardship messages, but actual real health messages that affect our day-to-day lives. Opening up the scale even larger, Greenwich Peninsula, the last bit of London that hadn't been developed in the east side of London. Very, very importantly for global climate change, next to the Thames flood barrier, which shuts far more often than it used to stop London flooding. And here is the peninsula, this big area of land, which was due for renovation. The last place in London, and this part of East London, to go from grey to green to grey. And oh, you see over this far side of the bank, which is Canary Wharf and the Isle of Dogs, the financial center of Europe, if you like. And here it was still green back in 1874. And it went grey about the 1900s, had the biggest gasworks in Europe on it, very contaminated. You probably couldn't breathe the air for more than about 10 minutes without seriously compromising your life expectancy. And the idea was, should we just do something about sailing or the Greenwich Meridian or some other big theme that could be the underpinning? And this was all discussed at great length. And we thought, no, actually, the regreening of Greenwich, the Hanging Gardens of Greenwich, could be a really interesting thing to do because there's nowhere like that in that part of London. And it really could change the whole feel of the place and respond to the other success stories that nobody knew about. In the 1960s, the river was biologically virtually dead. And but through introduction of sewage treatment works, the number of fish in the Thames had increased, but nobody knew about this. They couldn't see it for their own eyes. But this was species diversity. The actual number of species was very limited, and in the same way as at Wandsworth where we built the terraces, and I was working with Luke on this one as well, and people like Andy Grant, who's now doing work on this kind all around the world, is to say, look, we could just repair the wall, we could just deal with our buildings in our usual way, or we could say, let's worry about these guys. Let's worry about sea bass, who happen to live there. It's a nice, edible fish. Let's step the river back. Let's reverse the encroachment that has been going on for years and years. Plant native species and let them be covered by the tide and let them act as a fish nursery. And now that is the biggest sea bass fish nursery in the UK. And it's totally artificial. And here it is in another shot. And the diversity of the design, very interestingly, has maintained itself for over a decade now. But the informed design of the variety species matrix, because visual interest into architectural terms is still apparent in a totally submerged system a decade later. And then it's important to explain to people, because people won't understand, what are all the various things happening at the levels? What are the huge tidal forces? How much London water would London be under without the barrier? And the timeline of history, how have we learnt over time? All these things are very important parts of ecological design. And then we had a park to design for what is called the Millennium Village. And again, I worked on this with Luke, and he felt very strongly working with Ralph Erskine, as I did, that there should be a wetland. You think, well, hang on, that's mad. We're all against the Thames. Why have a wetland? They're a wetland. And actually, it's all the points there that the wetland here is not understandable. It's a dark river full of silt, and it's salty. This is a different type of wetland, and all those functionalities of biophilia can be brought to bear to a whole village encompassing it if we're clever. But then how do you stop all the wildlife you want there to attract, to entice and intrigue people from disappearing? Well, use water there again, so you have a moat around it, an interior core which is guarded, an exterior moat which is not. And you then have all the advantages of reflections and those sorts of elements of Erskine's architecture, which is so important to him, at the same time as the central core. And here you are returning landscape to what it might have looked like in Roman times with older car woodland. This is a created woodland completely on artificial soil 15, 20 years later with all the components you would find in a typical older car woodland. And then for the rest of the peninsula, how do you convince people that this sort of stuff isn't just a pocket in the middle? How do you take this over the architecture? And I couldn't get anyone to listen until one day I turned myself into a dragonfly. And I said, hang on a minute, what if I looked at the whole thing from the eyes of this guy and flew around it? How would the functionality ecosystem services make themselves apparent to me then? And it started to tell me that there was a way, a hierarchy of urban design around the buildings which gave precedence to ecology but allowed all the other functionalities to intersect with it. So you end up with a hierarchy of streets, from green streets to park streets to commuter streets, each which has a different element of ecological design in it. But when they meet, the precedence is given in design terms to ecology. So a street that you might want to sit around in has got verticality of green facades, it has water, it has all these elements that we've been talking about, that basically is a space where you want to spend a bit of time talking to your neighbor, and has these sorts of parameters and features in schematic terms. A place where you park your car may need trees to filter dust and take that out of the air and shade your vehicles and stop the car, the street looking like it's just a car park. But maybe that could be done with things like hazel, which you can coppice and use as a fuel. Maybe that species will also provide benefits because it is a native species of shrub. And then in spaces that you have to rush through in a hurry to the tube station, do they have to be devoid of any interest? Or could they make biophilic references in water and elements of design that relate to the river? And can that be in form and shape, enlightening people's lives as part of an overall mosaic of habitats? And at night, what happens? Night can enhance, lighting can enhance. This is with the top lighting architect in London who we worked with, and it was very interesting because they knew so much about lighting, but they didn't know about its effects. And it was about making all the good effects of lighting, which we love, without the really bad effects like disturbance of ecosystems and entrainment of bird life and disruption to migrant pathways. But it was the first site in London I'm aware of that had, as a whole regional area, a green roof strategy for the entire district. And this was the idea of urban heat island, reducing urban heat island and cooling, to get people at that stage in 1998 to listen. We ended up taking them to places like Switzerland to see for real what it looks like at the city scale. These are amazing sites. That's a hospital site with thousands of orchids on it in a very shallow soil. This is another curved roof with a biodiverse roof. And as you know, Urban Heat Island in 2003 killed a lot of people in London. 25,000 people in Europe died in the heat. And basically, that's just an example of what's to come. And actually, these urban cooling systems can be designed. They have to be on a big scale. And then how does the architect respond to that? This was one landscape architect's response of the many architects, landscape architects we work with, saying, well, the building can become an analog of a cliff. Different levels can respond to ecologies of different types. And we can work with all this. There's been papers in American institutions written about this sort of thing. So that you end up with iconic species such as this, which is a bird from Europe. There's one of the rarest breeding birds in the UK, which likes living in this sort of area, which is a flagship species for the green roof movement in the UK, which can live right on the tops of those structures. So we have a close urban block raising maybe 20 floors, and at every level of that structure, those color codes mean different habitats. And those habitats are responding to the microclimatic regime of that area, and that niche, and that shade regime, and that shelter regime. And you know, habitats like this are quite feasible in Transport for London's headquarters. Again, a synergy with photovoltaic sustainable energy generation on a small scale there. But going beyond that, we want to extend that whole pattern of habitats and styles to do more. Some of these wonderful examples is from America, from the USA in New York, Biggest Urban Farm in New York, which is a functional farm on a roof, which actually sells profitably its produce at ground level and is run by a cooperative. Why not do this more on roofs? William McDonough, a great advocate of this sort of thing around the world. And this is another example we'd love to bring to the Greenwich Peninsula. This is an example of a roof in Sheffield, which is a playground on a roof for young children. How did they get this past health and safety? And yet what a wonderful idea to explore natural environments at all levels on a structure when land is at a premium. My final study to leave you with is the Athletes' Village for the Olympic Games that just happened. We worked on that for 4 years on the design of the landscape. Now, the Athletes Village itself is part of the overall design of the Olympic Park, which was a regeneration of a very rundown part of London. You can see the village is here, and this slightly fuzzy picture shows the scale of it. It's quite a big bit of landscape in itself. The Olympic Park won all kinds of awards for its regeneration of a very polluted river, and we had to match into that and make it a functional setting for the athletes to use. But it was from the beginning designed as a legacy urban area. It's going to be, right now it has been bought and is being developed for housing. And the design is multifaceted and has many bits to it. But there wasn't a single bit of the design, including the blocks, that we didn't have a hand in. So for example, all these blocks, and there's a lot of them, everyone has a living roof. And the living roofs are designed not just as a thin skim of whatever may grow or a sedum roof, the idea was, what are the key habitats of the region? Can we actually get analogues of those habitats? Short grasslands, neutral grasslands, heathlands, all of which occur in the London Borough of Newham, and get analogues of them on the roof. And when we talk to soil scientists about how you create soils that underpin these most valued habitats in the UK, they couldn't answer. It wasn't even in some of the oldest textbooks. So believe it or not, we ended up going to some of these habitats in the Greater London area and sampling the soils, and then mixing that with soil technology to say, well, actually, in roof loading terms, how do you get all of those chemical properties whilst playing tricks on loading? And you end up with some of these sorts of mixtures for different habitat types as a first stab. And you're talking maybe 20 centimeters of soil. And again, coming back to the one in Zurich, I knew this could work. 20 centimeters of soil with a bit of sand created a national nature reserve with thousands of orchids, green-winged orchids every year, and many, many species of plant. So I believe this to be possible. We've started to do the heathlands on the roof. This is just early planting. And you know, the greening is just starting to happen. And we're monitoring now to see how these will develop and how much of the functionalities of the most valued semi-natural habitats in the UK we can restore. In the middle part, which is a very narrow space focused down on an axis going toward the Grand Union Canal, what do you do with that? It's an urban canyon. Well, again, as in Bedok in Singapore, we think, right, okay, a shaded woodland rill. We have topography changes, we have water, very sterile at this point because the planting hasn't been done for the aquatics, but it's all coming, and trees and many species. Even the non-natives were selected for the value to native fauna. But underneath, we worried about the ground level there, so there's underpinned by native native woodland flowers. You know, one of the biggest spectacles in wildlife, like it probably is here, is in the spring in England, the woodland ground flora. And that's integrated into this on totally artificial soils, man-made soils from scratch, from the cake mixes. And bringing in the elements of maturity from the beginning in the design so that you can maintain ecosystem balance. And right at the bottom of the site, this funny structure, which essentially is the kidneys of the entire living organism, which starts with the roofs. And this is taking water from all the roofs and the roads in different ways and actually treating it. So you end up with a system which Vogt, our landscape architects, Gunter Vogt of Switzerland, with the functionalities that we gave him made more beautiful, because he's a very good designer. But these functionalities were from us. And basically, you start with all the elements of a diverse system to increase the functionality. So here it is, and there are bits. And starting with, if you like, the two kidneys at the top, which are settlement areas where a lot of treatment happens just by settling processes. It filters from there to two woodlands. But to go through a woodland quickly would be no use. Water takes time on its journey to cleanse itself. So you have to take it on a trombone system through the wood. And this is early days after planting. But you can see the idea, and the water gets treated slowly, and woody material is very good at taking out phosphorus, whereas herbaceous material isn't. And then again, planting dead trees. Very, very odd to get that past the client base. But you know, you actually explain they're really important. Can't imagine the health safety loops we had to go through for this. But it's really important in terms of the ecosystem balance from the outset. And then through that, into what you call vegetated treatment systems, of which you probably know a lot. I mean, normally it's done with reeds, and it's a monoculture. But we said, no, we wanted to do a biodiverse system with 35 native species. So it looked like this, and it wasn't dominated by a few bully plants. And the big worry then is, what does it look like at different times of year? Can that work with the architecture? What does it look like in winter? Well, it looks all right in winter. So we're very careful balance of the ecologies and the plants chosen for their positions in the ecosystem relationship to each other, but also in relation to water treatment and their tolerance of pollution. And then finally, right at the end, a lake to polish the water, if you like, at the end with floating mats. And here it is at the end. And right in the bottom of it, a pump, which is the iconically positioned pump, because this is not just a bit of stuff to discharge the rivers to keep the fish happy. This water is then pumped back and used to flush toilets and to irrigate the landscape in what is a very dry place. London has as little rain as Basel. And actually, this is a very important thing. Sud systems in the UK are all about water cleansing, but water harvesting is a new concept, and it's not in our regs yet. So this is quite avant-garde for that. So this is how we're trying to make the whole landscape, over the buildings, down through, into the adjacent landscape and the view of the buildings, function in these ways and be beautiful and functional and relevant to the place that it's set. And I hope that 10 principles and 7 case studies haven't led you to feel that there is the sort of sent you to sleep in a sort of drug sort of way. But there is one final slide I'd like to show you, which I think is very important to end on, which is that right at the end, we looked back at all the elements we'd created here of wetlands, main parks, living roofs, and looked at their functionalities in all these different terms, and then discussed with the client whether that was working for those different functionalities. And at the end of it, our main aim is that in the architecture of the Athletes' Village is to change hearts and minds. And so I leave you with the words of Felix Guattari: there are three ecologies you need to address in your design, and I really hope in the next 2 days of the symposium we'll think of all three in the debates that I hope are very fruitful. Thanks very much.
If there are any questions, Mike is willing to take a few.
I think it's late.
It's late, yes. Are there other times when biodiversity is not a beneficial thing to try to achieve?
I'd look at it slightly differently. I think there's times when if you do it wrong, you get the wrong sort of biodiversity. Because any artificial creation can have unexpected consequences. I was reading today about the possibility in Toronto of introducing too many raccoons into a woodland that would start eating their way through your house, for example, or army ants climbing through an urban development in Brazil. So there is no one solution that is suitable for all locations. But I personally believe that the benefits are so strong that if there is a problem like that, then it's for designers to think about how to solve. Generally, the solution isn't going to be with an ecologist alone. It's going to be with a multitude of different techniques that you use to deal with that issue. The same way as if you trap biodiversity and you create unexpected consequences for the biodiversity itself, and you could kill things. But you know, I think the debate here is about a wider awareness and relationship with nature, because you know, many people have many times said that you know, it starts at home. If we don't have that respect for ecosystems on our doorstep and an understanding of natural processes, that education doesn't start in an ever urbanized world, where now, was it last year we passed 50% of the world urban, how the heck are you going to preserve rainforests? How is anyone going to understand these things? Kids in Greenwich that visit that park, the majority of those East End kids never leave London, have never been to the countryside. This is a first world country with a massive poverty situation in places like East London. And actually trying to get natural processes explained and actually seeing how things can be. There is a visitor book for the natural part there. So the risk you say, I'm not poo-pooing the risk you raise. But when you look at the benefits, I mean, there is a visitor book, and there's 10 years now of visitor books. And I've read all of them. I found one negative comment from the kids, and that was it wasn't big enough. So I think that there is a risk in everything, but I think the advantages so outweigh it that it's just something you have to take on board.
I love that you bring up the three ecologies, and when you read that piece, you have to ask, how on earth are we supposed to really combat the psychological and sociological barriers to achieving more reciprocal relationship with the environment? And do you really believe that biophila is able to combat the intense financial and ideological investment that is pitted against a more biodiverse society?
That's a really, probably the most relevant question anyone could have asked. And the answer is, I don't know. I hope so, but I'll give you two answers. When I was working in the Western Isles of Scotland, I was working on bird life, and there was a guy who had was the warden of a natural park up there, not Druidybeg Nature Reserve, and he was a Northumbrian farmer, not people traditionally associated with wildlife preservation. And he'd become a nature reserve warden, and I said to him once, I used to drink a lot of whiskey with him, and I said to him, why do you do this, Colin? This is, you know, you're stepping out of your comfort zone. He said, I'm a stubborn bugger, he said, and I like holding back the pace of the inevitable. In other words, whether you're right or not, you do it anyway. So that's the first answer. The second answer is that there's a chance, because actually, if you read Pavan's stuff and look at him on YouTube and what the economists of the world are saying about ecosystem services, if we can win the argument that it is ultimately an economic advantage to nations to do this, as is, for example, being realized by places like South Korea, of all places, then maybe we can depolarize the options. And it's not an either or. Obviously, at the moment around the world, a lot of what's going on is polar, and it is about, you know, the oblivion of everything environmental on the altar of short-term profit. But there are enough examples, and all we can do is point to the examples that are win-win and make it the king's new clothes. If you can't see it, you must be mad. I think that there's, again, two answers to this, and going back to the previous gentleman's comment about Felix Guattari, which is that the hope that he saw was in the anarchy that comes through individual action, which is being facilitated. This is not sidestepping your question, it's leading up to it. Basically, the anarchy that comes from individual action, which is facilitated by modern technology, which means that all of us that have at our disposal immense power through the internet to affect things and lobby and change things, even in China, where there's a big undercurrent coming from below government levels, way down at grassroots level, telling local people who are supposedly in charge that if they don't sort out the environmental situation, they ain't gonna wake up in the morning. And that there is a grassroots movement that no government, whatever its hierarchical label, can ignore. So I think that most governments, to one extent or another, are responding to what is becoming societal, if you like, a mind collective psychical change that we can energize through organization, through events like this, through a subtle process, the outcome and direction of which none of us is clever enough to predict. And I think that all governments, whatever their persuasion, whether they be Republican, Democrat, Tory, Labour, whatever you want to call it, are responding to one phase or another. There's no one saying this is not an agenda that's relevant to us. There may be, behind closed doors in Whitehall, a lot of cynical guffawing going on about, oh, I shot a few grouse yesterday, it was blah, blah, that's biodiversity for you. But actually, the reality is they're employing scientists in their civil services who are talking ecosystem services. The reality is that the hardcore advice they're getting is that this makes sense economically for society. And whatever the cynical persuasions of big business, whatever the cynical lobby that they then put on governments of whatever political persuasion, there's no getting away from the hard facts of the change, rate of change that we're seeing. And sooner or later, a government that doesn't address it becomes irrelevant. I think it's a pincer movement between the two. And we can only hope that the right outcome will obtain.
Well, I think we'll end there. If anybody has any questions, I'm sure Michael would be happy to address them, and he'll be here tomorrow as well. Just a reminder that we'll resume the sessions. There are three separate sessions on the schedule for tomorrow, beginning at 10 a.m. I believe I'm told there may be coffee, in fact, in the dome area before that, and maybe a bite to eat. Yeah, yes. No. So feel free to come a little bit early, and we'll get underway at 10 a.m. For a full day of different speakers on different topics. We'll make this a really interesting symposium. So. Thank you, and see you tomorrow.